Our next speaker is Michael Rice, who's a director at Rice Warner Actuaries. Michael is a director of Rice Warner Actuaries and has extensive experience in the financial services industry, both in Australia and overseas. He specialises in providing strategic advice to financial institutions, government agencies, industry associations, and large superannuation funds. Michael founded the firm in December 1987. And many of us here have heard and enjoyed hearing Michael speak on many occasions. And he is now going to talk to us on pensions affordability. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Martin. I'm getting old myself, so I have to decide whether to leave my glasses on or not for this. Australia, as you all know, is a lump sum society. We're unique in the world, or almost unique, in that we don't have annuitisation, and people are basically fend for themselves. They build a benefit and then have to work out how to use it. And in fact, most Australians spend their superannuation either very quickly or over a 5 or 10 year period and end up on the age pension anyway. So you could argue it's not that tax efficient to give generous concessions for superannuation than to give everybody an age pension as well, because both of these are very expensive. But the transition to a system which is more equitable is going to take a while, and I think the federal government changes recently are the first step in that direction. A couple of points about all of us. We, as you heard from Anne, we all like to retire early, irrespective of how much money we've got. Retirees, although they might be net savers, actually consume quite a lot of goods, particularly in the areas of health and aged care. So there will be quite a demand on the economy over the next 50 years as the baby boomers retire. It's a large voting bloc, so don't expect any government to easily be able to take back concessions they've made. Those people who think that tax-free pensions will disappear will be disillusioned, because there will be too many people getting them within 5 or 10 years for any short-term politician to be able to change it. And improvements in longevity, which I guess, short of getting a good dose of bird flu, we can expect will continue, and that's going to put a financial burden on us all. Some of the problems people have is that Australians tend to live for today and worry about how they're going to afford it tomorrow. That's at all ages. When people retire, they have absolutely no idea how they're going to live or how much money they should be utilising, how much they need to keep for later. And if they get a lump sum benefit of a few hundred thousand dollars, which is more than most get, they think that'll be enough to see them through, and then later on in life they're sorely disappointed. Just quickly on the age pension, it's means tested, and the means testing is relatively benign. It's set at 26% of average male earnings, even though the majority of pensioners are female. It was 25, but it went up by 4% when the GST was introduced as a concession for the increased spending that they would need on goods other than food, I guess. It's being raised for women gradually from 60 to 65. It's at now about 63, and I think it's 2014 it'll change. And it's at a fairly modest level. It's now $13,000 for a single person, about $22,000 for a married couple. It has gone up in real terms because it's linked to wages and not prices. So I guess if people can live on the pension, at least the benefit will be preserved in purchasing power. Most people think it's inadequate, and studies show that a benefit of 30 to 35% of average earnings would be more desirable to give a comfortable living standard in retirement. But one of the problems we have is that too many people get the age pension, so the cost of increasing it is extraordinarily high for government. So it's a bit of a balance between trying to keep people off the pension by encouraging self-sufficiency in retirement. But there's certainly no easy way of seeing benefits for people who are dependent on welfare to rise, given the large numbers I'll show you in a moment. other problems we have, or the government in particular faces on our behalf, is to how they do they increase these levels of self-sufficiency. They obviously encourage primarily for superannuation the people to save more, but the problem with the current system is there's no pooling of the risks on which individuals have got no real control. One of them is investment risks, and the other, which is probably going to be more important, is longevity risks. And a third one, I suggest, is how they should spend their money during retirement years. This gives you a little snapshot of males on the pension. The blue line shows you people who are on a full pension. Nearly 40% of males, by the way, have ceased employment by age 60. I suspect a lot of those are on disability pensions, not just the people getting retrenched. Some manual workers are forced out of employment because their bodies just don't cope as well as younger people. And at 65, about 30% of males go straight on to an age pension, so quite a modest income, and another 20-odd are on a part pension. Older Australians become more dependent for two reasons. One is when you take a snapshot like this, the older people retired in earlier years and they had less money, and also as they go through retirement, they tend to spend what they've got. Situation is relatively worse for females for a number of reasons. Their retirement benefits are lower, and of course they live longer, so they've got to spread the income over a longer period. And their dependency in later life grows significantly more than males. One encouraging sign is this shows you people on full pension over the last 5 years, and you can see that there's been about a 2% reduction, which implies that some of the means testing is working and saving the community money. And if you then look at part pensions, you'll see this is going up slightly, which is the converse of that. So the means testing is starting to bite a little bit, and that's a good sign for taxpayers. Just a quick background to the past retirement decisions, which are mostly obsolete today, or will be from July. There were three real groups of retirees, and Ant's comments on averages are quite pertinent, because you'll see figures that the average retirement benefit's about 87,000, 90,000 perhaps. But largely that's depressed by the number of people who get benefits of only 30 to 50,000 take them at 55. The human behaviour is such that if you've got under the tax-free lump sum of about 130,000 and you can take that from 55, then you may as well take the money, the current system, and pay off your debt or redo your kitchen, whatever you want to do, because you're going to be dependent on the age pension anyway, and you may as well have a good time with the little that you've got. So, in fact, if you look at average account balances for people between 60 and 65, they're significantly higher, because a lot of the people with the smaller balances do retire earlier. And so a lot of our financial planning in the past has revolved around this issue, where people with small benefits take them and leave and become dependent on the government. Smaller group with, say, 200 to 500,000 try and manipulate sometimes the age pension rules. They try and get a pension and supplement it with their own income. And between the two, they can generally get that comfortable lifestyle of 30 to 35% of average earnings. People with about 500,000, they tend to have tax minimisation policies because they usually have too much to really be able to manipulate age pension, although there have been some interesting ways of doing it. The budget impact, the theory is that it will lead to a deferral of consumption of retirement benefits, and part of the reason for that is that why would you take out any more than you need to consume immediately if you're over 60, given that you can leave it in a tax-free environment and presumably in a fund which will give you a good earning rate, more than you might expect in a bank, and therefore you may not get a lifetime annuity out of it, but you might at least leave your money in there over some sort of income stream, 5 or 10 years even. The shift also might encourage people at retirement to think in terms of an income stream, because if they're not going to withdraw the money, then they have to start thinking about the products that are available to them and how they might invest. And longer term, we will actually see people with higher balances at retirement. Even every year the balances get higher, but the dramatic change of people in their 20s to 40s using co-contribution and salary sacrifice is going to give them a much broader and better base for the future than the baby boomers, say. So even though we've seen tax concessions capped at 50,000, which for those over 50 is about half the old level, for those people starting early enough, that's not really going to be much of an issue. And really, it's a very small number of people that can afford to put 50,000 a year away anyway. There's been some comment about whether these are sustainable. As I said earlier, I don't think they're going to change. The voters won't allow them to. But the cost is about $500 million, as reported by Treasury, per annum. It's relatively small, even though it will obviously grow. The super taxes are about $8 billion a year in total at the moment. So every time a politician moans about industry fund and master trust fees, you might tell them their share is at least the same size. But the taxes are projected to increase in real terms as well. So the government's share of superannuation taxes is going to grow. Conversely, age pension costs are now over $30 billion a year, and they're projected to grow rapidly as well. So it's a bit of a balancing act for the government, because on the one hand, superannuation taxes give them a small contribution towards paying for the people who are on welfare in retirement. And their own Treasury's figures show that $30 billion will grow to $40 billion in about 5 years and then increase quite rapidly as the baby boomers retire. So we've done some crude modelling, not as good as Treasury. We think that the changes will have a surprisingly small effect on revenue and probably are sustainable. Just to show you, the amount of liabilities in the superannuation system is probably over $1,000 billion now, because assets are over $900 billion and the unfunded public sector liabilities are well over $100 billion. But what this shows you is projections we've done. The amount of money in the superannuation industry in relating to assets which are effectively tax-free on earnings and held in respect of pensioners is going to shift quite significantly in a relatively short period of time. And in fact, it grows quite significantly after this, as all the baby boomers have retired. So that has quite an impact on the industry. There may not be many annuities sold today and many products for people post-retirement, but that will probably change in quite a short time. One of the problems with designing products and assessing affordability for people in retirement is that retirement is at least three distinct phases. And typically, people when they first retire tend to have activities that are very similar to those they had when they were last working, apart from not having to go to work. If they play golf, they keep playing golf. If they want an overseas holiday, they keep doing it. But at some stage, the body and the mind slows down a bit and they become more sedentary, and they shift into a more passive frame, and expenditure patterns change then as well. And then finally they become frail if they're still alive, and the majority are, and then their expenditure needs again change, and it's a different environment. And yet all our products just assume that when you retire you'll just have a static income for life. I think when most people retire, they think the first phase is going to be the one they're in throughout retirement as well. most people can't envisage themselves sitting decrepitly in a nursing home. They just don't think it'll happen to them. It's a bit like young kids speeding. They don't think they're the ones that are going to run off the road. We've done some research, and we're doing more with ANU, on where expenditure will be in retirement, and the highest appears to be in the early stages, and whether that's because people have control over the funds and therefore they think they'll spend the money while they've got it, maintain their lifestyle. It's probably one area, but the other thing is that they have plenty of time and plenty of opportunities to spend it. When they fall back into the passive phase, and remember these phases vary not by any particular chronological age, but just really by the natural breakdown of the body, which varies significantly from individual to individual. And then they rise dramatically in the third phase, and largely that's because of aged care, accommodation and health costs, much of which are borne by the government, but quite a bit is borne by the individual as well. So you can see a traditional annuity doesn't really cope with the expenditure patterns for people except to cover perhaps basic regular expenditure. And I think in designing any products for retirement or encouraging, even writing up a financial plan, one needs to really understand these three phases so that people can manage their assets and their income accordingly. Here's a couple of the major items to show you for interest. Health expenditure goes up dramatically in the retirement years. The individuals, which is the yellow line, their share grows significantly. The red line is probably not significant. That's charities, employer plans, workers' comp, those sorts of things. But even though the government really does subsidise health costs significantly, individual costs do rise. That's for males. Pattern for females is similar. For some reason, I'm not quite sure why, above age 85, the costs for females are more than males, yet at the earlier retirement ages, they're pretty similar on average per person. That's where the money is spent, and you can see that aged care grows significantly from about age 75 onwards. There are other changes. Dental falls away. Maybe it'll make a comeback with teeth implants. And one thing to remember is when you get a lot of people in these age groups, these are based on historic patterns. They're probably going to rise dramatically. Medicine today allows people to have transplants well into older years of life, whereas in the past they might have been excluded on the grounds that it wasn't economic to keep them alive. So you might have found, say, 15 years ago, getting a kidney transplant was very difficult if you were 60. Now you might be able to get one if you're 70. That might not be a good example because there aren't enough kidneys to transplant anyway. But certainly you can get a hip operation or have open heart surgery in your 80s, and doctors might have said years ago that that just wasn't worth doing. And there's the same pattern for females. And you can see that these costs for individuals are quite high. So lifetime annuities, fortunately, these are probably the best product to take if you want to pool investment and longevity risks, but we're all familiar with the reasons why they're not sold. The reserving requirements basically force people to invest in fixed interest securities, which are inappropriate for long-term investments, depress the yield and make them look unattractive. And because people have a mindset of comparing the yield in year one with what they could get in an allocated pension, the latter always looks better, particularly in these bull markets, and so annuities are struggling a bit. There are some products such as the Astron longevity income stream that's trying to do things in a less capital intensive way, but the market's still out on whether that'll come in. If a pensioner took the minimum that they're forced to by the government from their benefit each year, you can see that the minimum withdrawal factors on the new pension arrangements are not that dissimilar to that on the market-linked income stream, although a little bit of a jagged line rather than the red one, which is more like an indexed annuity. The blue line I've just put in for interest to show if somebody did defer retirement for 2 years with the same benefit, they'd get a couple of grand a year more, which should make a big difference to their lifestyle. And that doesn't assume that they would have the 250,000 at 65 invested for 2 years and get two more years of contributions, because that would push the blue line up at least the same amount again. So deferring retirement is clearly a good option, although I can't see that any individual particularly wants it done to themselves. And this will just show you that pensioners need long-term investment strategies. They are going to live for quite a long time. If you ask somebody of 30 or 40 what they should invest in for 20 years, I'm sure you wouldn't tell them to get into cash. So why do you tell 65-year-olds the same thing? And just to give you an idea, I said earlier that most people seem to run out of money in 10 to 15 years, so it's not surprising that the majority end up on the age pension. Longevity is such that you can crudely say that half the people outlive their life expectancy. So we're going to get a lot of people in the older groups, and particularly in the very old groups where they're expensive. And perhaps government policy should be to get people to take their superannuation, live on it fully for 10 years without even drawing a part pension, and then getting a full pension later, because even that saves us a bit of money. The 65-year-old couple retiring on a full-age pension will cost the taxpayer about $375,000 over the balance of their retirement. And when you add the health costs to that, it's quite a big burden. So a couple of things to learn from this. You've probably gathered I'm not in favour of life stage type products, which get people out of growth assets before they retire. I think if you're going to have a lump sum and you've got a small benefit, then obviously you make your income more, or your pension benefit more stable. But if you're, I've seen products in the market that drop growth assets down to 30 or 50%, and they're clearly inappropriate for people who want to move into an income stream. They're very popular in the US, but that's for different reasons. That's a voluntary system, and it's usually a top-up. I think that super funds will develop different styles of benefits, and they may well split retirements for people into the amount that they need to put aside for their lump sum at retirement and the amount that they should be putting into their income stream. So rather than split funding by investment classes, you might split fund according to the expenditure needs that you'd have in retirement. If you do that, it's quite advantageous for a super fund to have a cash account, which is a tax-free earnings account, that might replace the individual's bank account in retirement. Because if you have a debit card and an ATM connected to that, you don't need any ETP for benefit payments over 60. It should be quite simple. Having said that, I don't think we'll see this in July, because the administration of super funds and the bank payment systems are not correlated in any way whatsoever. But it might concern the banking industry if something like this happened. Basically told you that calculators, I think, and this is a good actuarial tool, are needed, because all the ones I've seen really just help people build up their retirement, their pre-retirement benefit, and then don't really give an indication of how you can use your money thereafter. So it's a real vacuum in that area. I'm going to talk very briefly about reverse mortgages. These are new and, I think, reasonably exciting products, but I think there's a significant amount of mis-selling of them at the moment. Someone was quoted in the press this week saying that people might take out a reverse mortgage so that they could defer consumption of their superannuation. And I can't think of any practical example where that might be relevant. The interest rates on these products are quite onerous. Despite the very low debt-to-equity ratios, they're about 1% above the variable mortgage rates. And so that means that your super fund would have to earn more than 8 or 9% to make it worthwhile. And regularly, and while we've had that over the last 5 years, I think that's a risk that pensioners oughtn't to take. And this, although this is an extreme example, it does show you that if somebody takes out too high a debt-to-equity ratio early in life, that they're going, and even though there's a guarantee that the house won't be taken away from them, so they won't owe money when the loan exceeds the value of the home, they're still wiping out quite a bit of equity. It's less severe for males because we all die a bit younger. 20% is more structured, and to be fair to the product providers, they do tend to limit the debt to equity for those people taking it out at younger ages, but it is a concern that quite a few of these mortgages are being taken out quite young in retirement. So I think the greatest risk for retirees is living too long and not knowing how to cope with that financially and perhaps socially as well. I actually think most pensioners live quite well for the first 15 years. It's really only when the health problems start and they haven't got any super and they have no contingency plans that they have a problem. Most retirees wouldn't have a clue about expenditure patterns until the events crept up on them. They really do need to make long-term decisions about some of the things that will get to them later in their retirement years, particularly as the majority will encounter them. And they also should think about estate planning. And as an example, if you really want to leave your family home to your children, it seems to me to make a lot more sense when you want to put a new kitchen in to borrow 10 grand off your three middle-aged kids, not pay that back and then give them the whole home rather than give them what's left after a reverse mortgage, you know. And you don't need a financial planner to tell you that. I think there are going to be a lot of opportunities for our industry. I'm really interested to know whether the superannuation funds, as they move into post-retirement, will also offer quasi-banking services. They, as you know, some of the industry funds already offer through associated companies banking and credit card products. I think funds will all want to retain members at retirement, which again is another driver which might lead some of the corporate funds, the 180 of them that are left, to get out of running their super fund. And the funds themselves might find they've got huge cash flow. I think there's an $80 billion a year cash flow into super now. They want to know where to spend it. Well, the retired population itself needs facilities. There's a huge shortage of facilities, aged care, retirement villages. The funds themselves might actually move into these areas. And just to sum up, I think Australia's almost unique. I think we can also add New Zealand, but we're different to them in our lack of annuitisation. Our industry really needs to look very hard at how you can pool investment and longevity risks properly, and that will mean some innovative investment strategies and some smartly designed products. And fortunately, I think actuaries are well placed in both of those areas. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for that very wide-ranging and informative talk. We've got just a little under 10 minutes before morning tea for questions or comments on the many issues that Mike has raised. Who would like to ask a question or make a comment?
Gary Cox. Michael, what trends do you see in terms of life cover happening in the marketplace with the people tending to work longer?
With life insurance?
Life insurance cover, yeah.
It's a slightly different topic, but I think there are clearly some advantages in putting life insurance within super now with the removal of the RBL. can't put all forms of insurance in, but death and TPD certainly. And I think people will grow that. There's some trends that show that there's been a lot in the last few years about underinsurance, and I noticed that as industry funds are reviewing their benefit design, they're tending to set default levels higher. Australian Super, which was the ARF-STA merger, put their default premium up to $3 a week from 1st of November, and that'll probably generate $100 million a year in premiums. So, you know, I can only see that insurance will go up.
Mike, one of the early slides you had had a note there about the effective death duty of 15%, and I think that's one of the areas, the question of how the death benefits under the new superannuation structure that the government's talking about will affect people. Would you like to expand a little bit on that? Because I think that's something that's not well understood, certainly not by me.
Okay, the situation is that if you leave your benefit to a dependent after age 60, which is usually going to be a spouse, because your children generally, not always, but generally are not dependent at that stage, then that'll be a tax-free transfer to them. And they can either take it out of the fund, or I think they can leave it in some funds. If, however, somebody leaves no dependents, and that's as defined under CIS, so it wouldn't include same-sex partners, for example, then there are two components in the new regime. There's an exempt component, which has got basically a capitalised version of the pre-83 component, plus your own undeducted contributions. But the rest of the benefit, so that will be always be tax-free on return, but not the earnings on it. And the rest of the benefit will then be taxed at 15% if you leave it to a non-dependent or to your estate. I get that right?
Yeah. Fair number of nods from the audience, I think.
Yeah, there are people who are scheming to draw the money out the day before death, but because you can do that. But whether, I suppose if you've got an ATM card, it'd be interesting if people measured the time it was withdrawn.
David.
Yes, I'll just make a comment on that follow-up question before I ask my question. Absolutely right. In terms of payment to non-dependents, that's my understanding as well. And there is a potential loophole here. If you give your child a power of attorney, an ongoing power of attorney, and your parent is dying, and most parents don't at the age of 85 or 90 suddenly drop dead, they get moved into a nursing home or into hospital. So I can see a loophole being exploited by a child with an ongoing power of attorney to, in fact, withdraw all your super, as you can, and therefore avoid the death tax.
Mm-hmm. And particularly if you are yourself over age 60 at that time, you can put it in your own fund as an
under contribution. we've certainly advocated that all death benefits after age 60 should be tax-free. To simplify that, the government didn't pick that up, but otherwise funds are going to have to keep a whole lot of records for potential payment to non-dependents. The question I was going to ask, though, was you mentioned a couple of times that most Australians spend their super fairly quickly. I think that's probably true at the lower end of the market when they're under 100,000 and the age pension is very important. I suspect at the higher end of the market, people are fairly conservative because they're self-funded retirees. And I was wondering, as the super balances increase in size, which inevitably they will do over time and the SG system matures, whether in fact we'll see a growing proportion of aged or retired Australians being more conservative with their super money and not spending it quite so quickly.
It'd be interesting to know what the experience of people who run allocated pensions has been as to whether people try and draw the minimum if they've got large balances. But you're quite right. Certainly if people do become more conservative and more frugal, but I don't think that's before about age 70. it's only anecdotal. I'm not basing that on any thorough analysis. But certainly in a bull market where people are certainly far easier at spending their interest than their capital. So if their capital's preserved, so if funds are earning 8 or 9%, they're more likely to draw out that rather than the 4% minimum. I think the biggest problem is I don't know how seriously people look at it. I think they just decide they're going to do something and then the money's there and they take advantage of it. People with lots of money probably use a financial planner, probably have an estate planning policy, more complicated structures, so they would be different from the masses.
Probably got time for one last question, but yes.
Thank you. Gordon McKenzie, lawyer. Just a comment, Michael. The abolition of the RBLs and the implicit bias in RBLs for life-dependent pensions, is that going to cause problems in the system going forward as under the new system you can draw out as much or as little as you like after July next year? Or?
Yes, that sounds like something a lawyer should answer. I think the withdrawal of the RBL was partly the initiative of the government to try and simplify the system. There will be some people who will just see the tax-free environment and shove an incredible amount of money into their own DIY funds. I've heard of DIY funds of over $50 million existing already. And some of the people in them have thought that they're going to get huge windfalls. I actually think the government doesn't believe that people will have devious behaviour and that they will capture some tax on death in retirement. But I think the main trigger for the RBL removal will be that people are now more likely to put other assets into superannuation that they might be holding. They've obviously got to weigh up what the capital gains will be if they make a transfer in specie or whether they just sell and re-put in. But the financial planners certainly going around all their wealthy clients trying to encourage them to make use of the $1 million undeducted contribution in this year. It'll be interesting about this time next year when we see all the stats to see just what the cash flow into this current financial year will have been.
Well, thanks very much, Mike, for the insights into products and what the landscape will be under the new superannuation tax arrangement. So could we once again thanks Mike for his talk and answering questions.